Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, March 28th. I'm Kara Randolph reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, parking concerns voiced at WIAT Housing Projects meeting and the KMUD News Sports Report. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Affordable housing in Eureka is being expanded with two projects led by the WIAT Tribe, and parking emerged as a top concern during a community meeting. Daniel Mintz reports.
Two Eureka affordable housing projects led by the WIAT Tribe have numerous features for seniors and families, but parking issues figured prominently in a public meeting. The projects, slated for city parking lots at 6th and L Streets and 5th and D Streets, were up for public comment during the March 26th meeting held at Eureka City Hall with online participation. 52 units of affordable senior housing are planned for the 6th and L Street site, with studios, one-bedroom and two-bedroom rental units. Monthly rents will range from $316 to $959, depending on tenant incomes. The 5th and D Street family-oriented project consists of 41 one-, two-, and three-bedroom units, with rents there ranging from $300 to $1,100. Each project will cost about $27 million to build. Both projects are on city parking lot sites, among several city lots being converted to affordable housing. Tribal members will be prioritized for tenancy, but the units will be available to others once tribal need is met. During a public comment session, Chris Larson, owner of North Coast Audio on 5th Street, said he supports the project there, but has concerns about its potential business impacts.
I am concerned as a business owner who relies on every single bit of parking we get to get. I mean, not going to lie, parking's a big issue. And I'm scared to death about what this project is going to do to my business. Again, I'm a supporter. We need housing in this town. But I don't feel like there's been anything to address businesses in this plan, and nothing I've seen. It's a beautiful building, by the way. Good job.
Laura Heron, an architect for the Kansas City, Missouri-based Travois Affordable Housing Consulting Firm, acknowledged the concern, saying, quote, "We've heard them and we'll see how we can incorporate some of your thoughts." A more detailed discussion on parking was had in this exchange between another business owner and Kristen Kenyon, Eureka's Director of Development Services on the 6th and L Street project.
I'm a small business owner downtown. And like other businesses in the area, I heavily rely on the 6th and L parking for my patrons. You say that you're going to have the kitchens open and serve the community, et cetera, but where are these people going to park? There's literally been no parking for all this time. We've been fighting for parking for years, and now that's going to be removed. And it looks like the 6th and L, what you were saying is that the city employees will have the ground floor of the structure, will accommodate 20 dedicated city vehicle parking spaces in a separate garage accessed by the alley. But why are we pushing away the people that shop down there, the people that actually work down there? It seems kind of tone deaf to say, hey, we know there's a parking issue. We've already gone over that, but we're going to ignore that and put up. What is the plan for that? Like, is there a way that the parking on the ground level could be increased to accommodate more parking spaces and be open for the public use? Because I don't understand where, like, the 6th and L, if you're going to have elderly people, are these people going to be, like, assessed if they have cars? And then if they have a car, they're not going to be living there because there's no parking for them? Or is it just going to be madness down in the city on 7th and 6th, where we're all looking for a place to park in front of people's houses?
We currently have no issue at City Hall finding parking within two blocks of City Hall. We've looked at parking utilization. We have a lot of underutilized parking. There are certain areas like around the courthouse where there's high utilization, but then there's spots within a few blocks of there that have empty spaces. So we've realized that we We have more of a parking management issue than a parking supply issue in downtown and Old Town. And we have a multitude of strategies that we're working on to address that. For instance, we've now striped a lot of the street parking so that people park more efficiently. And we've hired a parking enforcement officer. We're working on the parking timings and parking metering and parking permitting for employees and residents to utilize the parking lots. We're also looking into a shuttle.
On the 5th and D family housing, someone questioned why the project isn't being sited closer to schools and got this answer from Kenyon.
Unfortunately, in California, the school districts aren't needing to think about where they're locating schools and whether they're locating them near jobs and services. So unfortunately, in California, a lot of times schools are not located where all of our jobs and services are located. And so I've heard the argument that like, oh, this isn't near schools, but if you locate things near schools, then they aren't necessarily located near jobs and services. So there's not an ideal location where you get all things in one spot, unfortunately, in Eureka, because the schools aren't as centrally located.
What's been described as a housing crisis is affecting many residents, but WEA Tribal Administrator Michelle Vassal said tribal members are exponentially affected. She said, quote, "Just imagine that as an indigenous person to this area, your people have been here since time immemorial, and you can't afford to live here anymore." The next benchmark for the projects will be reviews by the Eureka Design Review Committee. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Ray Hamill brings us details of all the big local sports stories of the week, including some changes at College of the Redwoods, all the latest high school and college baseball and softball news, and who impressed at this week's HDNL Boys Golf Opening Round.
College of the Redwoods announced some big changes within the school's athletic department this week. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the changes at CR in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including all the latest high school and college baseball and softball news, as well as some high school golf and why it will be a big weekend for one Cal Poly Humboldt team. But first up, College of the Redwoods announced on Tuesday that Justin Kloss is taking over from Ryan Bizio as head coach of the men's basketball team, and that Bizio has been named the Corsairs' new athletic director on an interim basis. The changes will take effect this summer. Kloss has worked closely with Bizio since he was hired as head coach of the program in early 2019, and he was named associate head coach of the team in 2022. But with Bizio switching roles within the department, Kloss will now take over a program that has enjoyed tremendous success in recent years. During their time together, Bizio and Kloss led the Corsairs to 4 conference championships in 5 full seasons. Bizio said, quote, "Justin has worked tirelessly on behalf of our players and has earned the opportunity to lead the men's basketball program," end quote. Bizio, meanwhile, has served as an assistant AD within the department for much of the past 2 years. He will replace Bob Brown as AD, with Brown stepping into an expanded role overseeing campus life and student conduct, according to a press release announcing the news. Elsewhere in local sports this week, the weather continues to impact the high school baseball and softball schedules. Several teams, however, did manage to get in some much-needed game time over the weekend. On Friday, the Arcata baseball team traveled to Lake County to play Kelseyville, and they split a doubleheader, taking game 1 10-1 and dropping game 2 7-6. The Tigers are now 5-2 on the season. The defending Big 5 champion McKinleyville Panthers also were in action over the weekend at the Wairika tournament. The Panthers opened tournament play with a 12-1 win over Mount Shasta and followed that with a 7-3 win over Aetna before suffering their first loss of the season, falling 8-1 to Wairika. The Panthers are now 7-1 on the season. Del Norte and St. Bernard's also traveled for the tournament. The Warriors won all three of their games on their way to the tournament championship, beating Etna 9-3, Mount Shasta 8-2, and St. Bernard's 4-2, and improving to 4-4 on the season. The Crusaders opened with a 5-2 win over Etna before dropping back-to-back games against Mount Shasta and Del Norte. St. Bernard's also defeated Fortuna on Tuesday 6-0 and is now 3-3. The Huskies also played a doubleheader at Point Arena over the weekend, taking both games 8-1 and 12-2, and they are now 3-5. The Eureka boys, meanwhile, ended a 17-day break between games on Tuesday when they played a doubleheader against Fort Bragg, losing Game 1 10-6 and taking Game 2 5-4. The Loggers are now 2-3. The Hoopa and South Fork baseball teams were also in action this week. Hoopa beat Trinity 20-6 on Monday and improved to 3-1, while the Cubs swept a doubleheader against Hayfork on Monday, winning 11-3 and 9-2 and improving to 4-3. Conference play begins next week with 8 games on tap. The Little Four gets underway on Tuesday when Hoopa plays at South Fork and Ferndale travels to St. Bernard's. On Thursday, South Fork plays at Hoopa and St. Bernard's plays at Ferndale. The Big Five gets underway with a pair of doubleheaders on Saturday of next week, with Eureka playing at Fortuna and Del Norte traveling to Arcata. In local softball, meanwhile, the Fortuna girls continued their fast start to the season with a commanding 21-1 win at Eureka on Tuesday. The Huskies improved to 7-1, while the Loggers dropped to 0-2-1. The McKinneyville girls also were in action over the weekend, losing both ends of a pair of doubleheaders at Foothill and West Valley and dropping to 3-4 on the season. The Del Norte girls travelled this week to compete at a Jamboree in Medford and won all three of their games, defeating LaSalle 11-10, Redmond 3-1 and Ashland 10-0. The defending Big Five champs are now 5-1. The Hoopa girls also travelled to play at the Medford Jamboree and lost all 5 of their games, dropping to 0-5 on the season. The Ferndale Wildcats split a pair of doubleheaders at Calistoga on Saturday and at Trinity on Tuesday. The Cats lost their opener against Calistoga 3-0, but responded with an 11-1 win in Game 2, before winning Game 1 at Trinity 6-5 in 8 innings, and losing Game 2 10-7. They are now 3-3 on the season. St. Bernard's travelled to compete at the weekend Bigs tournament and went 2-2 over the 2 days. The Crusaders dropped their tournament opener to Etna 6-4 before winning back-to-back games against Portola and Modoc by scores of 14-2 and 10-1. They closed out tournament play with a 3-1 loss to Bigs and are now 4-5. Conference play in softball also begins next week. The Little Four kicks off with a pair of doubleheaders on Thursday, with St. Bernard's playing at Ferndale and South Fork playing at Hoopa. The Big Five begins 2 days later, with Eureka playing a doubleheader at Fortuna and Del Norte travelling to Arcata for 2 games. In local college softball, the Cal Poly Humboldt women lost 3 of 4 games at Cal State East Bay last weekend and dropped to 19-14 overall and 8-10 in conference. While in college baseball, College of the Redwoods lost 2 of 3 games against Butte over the weekend. The Corsairs dropped the opener 11-4 before taking Game 2 7-6 and losing Game 3 18-3. They are now 5-15 overall and 2-9 in conference. In other Cal Poly Humboldt sports news, the Jacks rowing team will host its annual Blue Heron Regatta, the team's only home event of the season, out on the Humboldt Bay on Saturday morning, with the action starting at 8 a.m. And finally this week, the HDNL boys golf season got underway at the Redwood Empire Golf and Country Club in Fortuna on Monday, and it was a good start for the host school. The Huskies won both the team and individual events, with Dawson McWhorter carding a 76 for a one-stroke victory. And that's this week's K-Mud News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
In national news, the Department of Health and Human Services prepares to cut 10,000 more jobs. Edwin J. Vieira reports.
The mass firings are likely unlawful, will likely be challenged in court, and we also know it does nothing to improve the health, safety, and economic well-being of the American people. It will hurt it.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says it's unclear if announced firings at the Department of Health and Human Services will happen or what their result would be. Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced 10,000 staffers will be dismissed, doubling the total of already announced layoffs and voluntary departures. One previous agency head says the firings seem to be based on the delusion that employees there aren't actually doing anything, and others say it could mean a man-made disaster dealing with problems like the current measles outbreak. Meanwhile, election experts doubt President Donald Trump's election-related executive order will go into wide effect. The Constitution gives the job of election administration to the states. While Congress has passed laws that force or entice states, that typically takes more than a presidential order. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says reaction at the state level will be partisan.
Unfortunately, I think you've seen some Republicans. I saw a statement from the Secretary of State of Florida who said that this was welcome. I don't know that he would have said the same thing if President Biden had tried to do an executive order of this type.
Then President Joe Biden signed a voting order after a related bill failed in the Senate but was met by stiff GOP resistance. Trump's executive order requires a passport or similar document as proof of citizenship to vote. Critics charge it would depress turnout, noting even most Trump supporters don't have a passport. States like New York are considering legislation to broaden voting rights. Along with almost $11 million for voter outreach, lawmakers are debating enhanced automatic voter registration and protecting voting for eligible folks awaiting trial behind bars. Stephen Choi with New Yorkers for Inclusive Democracy says it's a reaction to moves like Trump's.
They're going to try to make sure they use these myths about fraud to try to cut down on voting rights, especially for communities of color, for Black, Latino, Asian communities.
President Trump withdrew the nomination of New York Representative Elise Stefanik to be UN ambassador. House Republicans say an open seat in a possible swing district could threaten their razor-thin majority. Trump says he may consider the close ally for a future position. Stefanik has been the New York 21st District Representative since 2014 with strong support, in spite of the seat being previously held by Democrats. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
First Republican joins Dems calling for investigation of Yemen war plan group chat security breach. Eileen Alfandari reports.
Armed Services Committee Chair Roger Wicker is the first top Republican lawmaker to publicly break ranks with the Trump administration over the seriousness of the security breach that some have labeled Signalgate. Wicker and the committee's top Democrat are calling for an independent investigation into the leak of sensitive deliberations over the messaging app Signal over whether, when, and where to bomb Yemen. Wicker said he believes the information should have been classified. At a hearing of the House Intelligence Committee, National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard repeated the contention that the text did not contain any classified information. That didn't go over with committee Democrat Joaquin Castro of Texas.
You know, the idea that this information, if it was presented to our committee, would not be classified, y'all know is a lie. That's ridiculous. I've seen things much less sensitive be presented to us with high classification. And to say that it isn't is a lie to the country.
Gabbard did allow, though, that mistakes were made.
It was a mistake that a reporter was inadvertently added to a Signal chat with high-level national security principals having a policy discussion about imminent strikes against the Houthis and the effects of the strike.
Democrats grilled Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe about the incident. Both of them were on the group text chain on Signal. Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, was also added somehow. On Wednesday, his publication released more of the chats, showing the level of detail they offered about the strikes. In the group chat, Pentagon Chief Pete Hegseth shared the exact timing of warplane launches and when bombs would drop. Colorado Democrat Jason Crow castigated Hegseth.
Well, we send our men and women downrange to do incredibly difficult, incredibly dangerous things on our behalf. And yet, nobody is willing to come to us and say this was wrong. This was a breach of security and we won't do it again. It is outrageous and it is a leadership failure, and that's why Secretary Hegseth, who undoubtedly transmitted classified, sensitive operational information via this chain, must resign immediately.
Illinois Democratic Senator and combat veteran Tammy Duckworth, in a statement, called Hegseth a, quote, effing liar, who recklessly leaked information that could have gotten U.S. pilots carrying out the bombardment killed. Los Angeles Democrat Jimmy Gomez brought up Hegseth's well-known trouble with alcohol as he questioned Gabbard and Ratcliffe.
To your knowledge, do you know whether Pete Hegseth had been drinking before he leaked classified information?
I don't have any knowledge of Secretary Hegseth's personal habits.
Director Ratcliffe, yes or no?
You know, no, I'm going to answer that. I think that's an offensive line of questioning. The answer is no. I find it interesting that you want to...
You asked me a question, you want an answer? No, listen,
you don't
want to
focus on the good work that the CIA is doing, that the intelligence community...
Director, I reclaim my time. Director, I reclaim my time. Here... I have huge respect for the CIA, huge respect for our men and women in uniform. But this was a question that's on the top of minds of every American.
Hegseth took no questions from reporters as he left on a trip to the Indo-Pacific, but said no one was texting war plans. President Trump called the uproar a witch hunt. At the White House, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt laid into Atlantic editor-in-chief Goldberg, calling him a propagandist who pushes hoaxes.
Goldberg is an anti-Trump hater. He is a registered Democrat. Goldberg's wife is also a registered Democrat and a big Democrat donor who used to work under who? Hillary Clinton.
Meantime, the watchdog group called American Oversight has sued Hegseth and other officials for using Signal to discuss the attack plans. The group says they violated federal records laws by using the messaging app for high-level national security deliberations. The lawsuit seeks to recover unlawfully deleted messages and to prevent further destruction. The judge who's been assigned to the case is James Boasberg. He's already in the administration's crosshairs for his orders, which sought to block the removal of Venezuelan migrants who were sent to a notorious Salvadoran prison and work camp in apparent defiance of the judge. While the fallout continues to swirl over the messaging app scandal, Michigan Democrat Rashida Tlaib said on social media that there was, quote, more heat for using a group chat than for the bombing itself. Appearing on Democracy Now!, journalist Safa Al-Ahmed noted that today marked the 10th anniversary of the beginning of Saudi Arabia's deadly years-long bombing campaign against Yemeni Houthi rebels, which largely ended with a truce in 2022. Al-Ahmed said this month's U.S. attacks are just the latest chapter in Yemen's suffering.
They want to bomb Yemen, regardless of whether they're attacking the Houthis or they're claiming to attack ISIS and Al-Qaeda there. Regardless of that, they continue to change the targets of who they are killing in Yemen. But regardless of that, they are killing Yemenis with no recourse for the Yemenis themselves. So whether it's the interests of Europeans or the Americans, it's been going on in Yemen for so long now with zero accountability.
I'm Eileen Alfandari for KPFA News.
Uber, Lyft drivers, lawsuit claims wage theft. Settlement negotiations begin Monday. Christina Onnested reports.
Ibrahim Diallo is a rideshare driver based in San Francisco and among the 5,000 Uber and Lyft gig drivers who filed wage claims with the California Labor Commission, accusing the companies of wage theft. Diallo tells KPFA he saw his wages continue to decline as the company took more and more out of his pay.
They used to take 20% and we take 80%. From there, they became more greedy and then they started taking 25%. And then later on, they also changed the contract and then they started taking 30%. But the sad part is even the 30%, the 70% we are supposed to get, we're not receiving it. Many times when I check, about 98-99% of the time, I realize they did not even pay me 50%. So those are the wage losses we are fighting for.
The workers claim they were misclassified as independent contractors after California's AB 5 law required they be treated as employees. But they say Uber and Lyft never followed the law, denying them overtime, minimum wages, meal and rest breaks, and mileage reimbursement. Diallo says the scope of the suit extends beyond 5,000 original claimants to an estimated 250,000 gig workers who drove for Uber and Lyft between the years 2016 and 2020. That could cost the company tens of billions in returned wages. He says the stolen wages caused undue stress and near homelessness.
It's becoming very difficult for me to have the basics of life. Even paying my rent became very difficult. I'm going through that hardship, and I'm not the only one. Many, many drivers are going through the same scenario. Many, many unfair deactivation, and all these wage losses affecting a lot of Uber drivers. This is even pushing many Uber drivers to stop driving.
After failing to comply with the law, Uber and Lyft then invested $200 million to defeat it through a state proposition, Prop 22, which voters ultimately approved, clarifying gig drivers are independent contractors, not employees, in 2020. In a statement to KPFA, an Uber spokesperson said drivers come to Uber precisely because of the unique flexibility it provides. Prop 22 safeguarded their choice to work independently while ensuring important new protections. The voters of California have spoken overwhelmingly, and we look forward to putting these years-old matters behind us. But the group Rideshare Drivers United disputes gig drivers are independent. It claims true independent contractors decide what prices to charge their customers, while Uber and Lyft fix prices charged to customers and its pay formula to drivers based on hidden algorithms that are not disclosed to either. Settlement negotiations begin Monday, March 31st. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for KPFA.
Israel's renewed military actions in Gaza has killed nearly 1,000 Palestinians since March 18th, according to Gaza health officials. Rami Amalari reports from Gaza.
Israeli renewed military action across the Gaza Strip has led to the deaths of nearly 1,000 Palestinians since March 18th, according to Gaza health officials. The latest casualties in air strikes include a key Hamas spokesperson, Abdul Latif Al-Kanoua, who was taking shelter alone in a tent in northern Jabali refugee camp when he was killed. Fatma Al-Najjar is an eyewitness of the strike.
What should I describe to you? A very frightening scene where people escape among tents and carry bleeding children. What they do is only firing missiles on tents.
Another Israeli airstrike hit a house nearby, killing 12 people, including children. This comes after weekend strikes targeted two Hamas senior leaders, including a member of parliament. The Israeli army had said its latest round of strikes would target all Hamas-affiliated bodies, including administrative, civil service, and legislative arms. In another Israeli army shelling, the premises of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Rafah was hit. Israel's ramped up attacks on Gaza have led to discontent of Hamas rule. Dozens rallied in northern Gaza against Hamas negotiators outside of Gaza, saying they are out of touch with the lived reality of Palestinians here, demanding Hamas negotiate a ceasefire and hostage release. Israel's army has also issued evacuation orders for populated neighborhoods, citing Hamas rocket fire into nearby Israeli communities. Jihad Al-Akluk is a resident of Deir el-Balah town in central Gaza Strip.
In here, we lack the safety now to the extent that we cannot go for family visits during these times and even in the upcoming Eid after the holy month of Ramadan. We will not be able to visit family members. What more should I say? It is no longer safe here.
Israeli strikes also killed two local journalists, including a team member of the Al Jazeera Arabic channel. An Israeli army statement reads that the Al Jazeera's crew member is a member of a Hamas sniping unit. Sami Abu Salem is a freelance journalist and head of Journalists' Safety Unit with the Palestinian Journalists' Syndicate in Gaza.
Unfortunately for now, when a journalist heads for work, he or she does not guarantee they will return back home safe. Actually, Israeli bombs have destroyed all safety-related principles. They have also destroyed all other laws and norms. One feels frustrated, actually. Back in 1948, they were able to commit massacres against Palestinians, for there were no cameras. For now, there are cameras while they continue to kill. That is because they are being backed by repression powers of this world.
Amidst this military escalation, Arab and U.S. mediators have been involved in talks with both Israel and Hamas. Hamas says it is ready to release Israeli hostages in return for a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and end of current war, a proposition Israel has previously rejected. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Al-Mighari, in Gaza.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer and thanks to our reporters. KMUD News is also online, and you can find us at kmud.org, where our stories are also in print. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. Reporting for KMUD in Redway, I'm Kara Randolph.